Hello, my name's Paul Greatrix. This latest episode of My Imaginary University was, excitingly, recorded live in front of an audience at the recent Wonky Festival of Higher Education. Many thanks to Wonky for inviting me, and special thanks too to Jim Dickinson for all the help with making the recording happen. Our creative force on this occasion is Graham Wise, who is Director of Strategic Programmes and Engagement at the University of London, who's imagined a big and bold institution operating on a genuinely global scale. World Multilateral University, also known colloquially as Olympic University, is a worldwide research institution operating under treaty, which brings the world's best academics together in focus groupings to address the biggest research challenges there are for 4 years at a time. There's a well-staffed permanent secretariat based in a pleasant city, and all staff enjoy some special privileges, including magic passports which get them through all borders without delay. Every 4 years, the university has a 2-month-long in-person plenary session to review progress and plan the next round of research. It sees itself as the opposite of the Davos experience. Our audience chips in with some excellent questions for aspirant President Graham, covering topics ranging from strategic planning to IP to secret handshakes. We also learn that the university's theme tune leads staff to imagine they're running along a beach whenever they hear it played. Or maybe not. Anyway, it's a terrific proposition and a really good discussion. I do hope you enjoy it. Right, good morning, everyone. It's great to be back here at the Festival of Higher Education with Wonky. And this is another live recording of the My Imaginary University podcast. So My Imaginary University is a podcast where every time a notable sector figure is asked to create and describe their ideal imaginary university. So it's a bit like, you know, Desert Island Discs, but without the Desert Island, the music, the book, the luxury, or indeed the celebrity. However, we do have big cheeses from higher education, vice chancellors, agency leaders. We've had Wonky staff and contributors as well, all of whom over the years have come up with very different kinds of institutions. We've had the University of Harold Wood, the Politecnico de Wakefield, Democracy University, Roosevelt U, and the University of All the Fields. So this time, I'm really pleased that my guest is Graham Wise, who's someone I've been trying to get to do this for a long time, and I'm really delighted he's doing it here at Senate House in the University of London, where his office is just around the corner. He's Director of Strategic Programmes and Engagement at the University of London, previously worked at UKRI and also University Alliance, and before that, the National Union of Students for a number of years. So he knows the sector extremely well, and he will, I'm hoping, come up with something very novel and interesting and different. And just to be clear, I've given him some broad areas to think about in terms of what he might like to do in terms of creating his imaginary university. I've got no blimmin' idea what he's going to come up with. So, you know, we're all in the dark, right? So we'll be exploring this together. So let me hand over without further nonsense to Graham and to hear from him what he's come up with in terms of his imaginary university. And then I'll ask him some questions, and then I'll throw it open to you to ask him some more probing questions, and then we'll see how we get on. So Graham, what have you got for us?
Well, Paul, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. My imaginary university is officially called the World Multilateral University, or for informal shorthand, you could call it the Olympic University.
Right.
And the World Multilateral University is a global research-centered institution with a faculty comprised of talented scholars delegated to it from participating nations. And it's founded by international treaty. So that's voluntarily entered into by its member countries, and it stands completely outside national regulatory and funding systems. The university works in 4-year cycles in which subject clusters would be convened by leading academics in those fields, and the included subjects would change slowly over time, with new areas of inquiry coming in and others winding up. And in addition to conducting research across that range of fields, the university would also have a general mission to promote multilateralism as an approach to into international relations. So it's a key multilateral body. There'd be a permanent presidency and secretariat, which that would be based in one location, but generally subject clusters would have autonomy to lease sites in locations relevant to their research and their research questions for the duration of the four-year cycle. And at the end of every cycle, so every 4 years, the university as a whole would meet in plenary, all its member academics across all the subjects in a major global city for, I'll say, about 2 months. And we'll come back to, there are reasons for that. We'll come back to that. And although primarily research-based, there will be doctoral students and opportunities for taught undergraduates and postgraduates to join the plenary element to work towards a credit-bearing short course. And that's my imagining it first.
Blimey. So it's fairly modest ambition then that you've got.
Yeah.
Right. So there's an awful lot of questions immediately arising. Mm. Starting with the permanent presidency and secretariat.
Mm.
Where is that based? Just out of interest.
So I think I'll answer that, but it would probably be helpful to just take one step up from that and just talk a little bit about the governance structure just first. So as I said, the university is founded by an international treaty between the participating nations.
And that's
called the World Multilateral University Convention. So it's a treaty.
Snappy.
And that would be the constitution of the university and set up all the governance structures. And the convention would also give the university research degree awarding powers and the power generally to award academic credit. So that would be within the scope of that treaty. Mm. And the presidency and the secretariat would probably be based in a neutral country. So Ireland, Switzerland, Austria, for example. But otherwise, there's no permanent campus. The secretariat is there, but the campuses, if you like, or the research sites would be flexible and would change over time.
But the fundamental idea, though, is that by putting these groups of researchers together for a period in a themed area, essentially they produce novel and outstanding research that wouldn't necessarily be the case if they were scattered around 20 different universities. So you're going to do something special and different.
What I'm trying to do is create a structure to bring together academics from across the world that doesn't belong to any nation and that they would collaborate in a research endeavor with a fixed kind of time horizon, although it might be renewable once, so you might have 8 years, you might think about it like that, under the leadership of a leading academic in that field, but where they've generally had the autonomy to structure that research program in whichever way meets the research aims and research questions that they have.
How do those research areas become ones that the university identifies then?
Yeah.
So if it's decided that, we're gonna have a grouping that's gonna bring all the malaria scientists from around the world together to really nail malaria once and for all, how does that come about?
Yeah, so every 4 years, the university secretariat would run a global competition.
Right.
And initially that competition would be for the senior academic leaders, the senior professors, who would become the leads for that research program. So they would be recruited first for a four-year term, and then they would have considerable autonomy working with the secretariat to shape the research program, including shaping the call for new academics to join them, the kinds of academics they'd be looking for. And then the majority of those places would be for countries to run their local competitions, so they form an academic delegation. So you'd have delegations roughly proportional in size to the academic workforce in every country that subscribes to the university. That gives you the scale. And there might be, on top of that, some kind of additional places. So if you found that you had a gap that wasn't addressed within the delegation, you'd be able to have a worldwide competition for that place.
Okay. My mind is immediately, drawn to the detail of the nightmare for planning all of this, right?
Well, yeah.
And how bloody difficult it's going to be. But let's skate over the problems. Look at the solution. Because actually, I think what this says is that in order to get to a point where you've got all those researchers together in the one place, I'll come back to the place thing in a minute, actually there's an awful lot of planning as well as the kind of competition and selection that's required to get there. So it's quite a long lead time on these things.
It's a long lead time. And I think I should probably just say, I do visualize this as being a very major research institution in the world. So I would see it as being having a very substantial budget and significant financial.
So where does capacity. The money come from, Graham?
Yeah. So
who's paying for this?
Right. So
to see.
Yeah. Well, I've done a bit of thinking about that.
And
I've crunched some numbers, and I'll give you. And there are different models that you could use to do this, but I think it would be important to have. I mean, basically, the core funding model is subscriptions from the participating nations,
right?
So it's governments that are paying for this, and that's detailed in the treaty. It would be important to have a funding level that and a funding mechanism that allows you to meet the very significant operating costs, which you've, as you rightly said, that would be needed, but also to balance that with equity factors and global justice factors. So obviously, not all nations in the world have the same capacity to fund such a thing. So here's an example of how you might do it. If every nation in the G20 subscribed and they paid 0.005% of their GDP to the university, that would give it an operating budget of about $7 billion a year, which is about the same as the operating budget of Harvard. For the UK, to give you some sense of scale for that, that would be about £140 million a year, which, I mean, we're about to all be told in a few weeks, so there's no way we could afford that. But in different parts of the economic cycle, that actually isn't outside the realm of the sort of thing our government might finance. And it's less than the Hythe grant, it's less than the grant for ARIA. So it's within the bounds of.
Okay. And we'll assume for the sake of argument that, you know, everyone plays ball and even crazed US presidents sign up to this. But we'll assume that for the time. Okay. I think that sounds not unreasonable as a perspective. What about then so if the UK loses, you know, all its malaria scientists for 4 years to, you know, this particular project, how are those institutions going to feel? I mean, about those, you know, those people that they've been recruiting and then paying for and then supporting and providing labs for, et cetera,
yes.
Buggering off to, you know, wherever this happens to be?
It's a very good question and becomes an even more acute question when thinking about developing countries and nations of more limited capacity in their research system. So I think that one of the things the Secretariat would be empowered to do with this very substantial budget I've described is for some cases, they would make remediation arrangements with the country that's provided the delegation. So there are many countries in the world where you would not want to remove from them their only epidemiologist, for instance. And so it would be, the Secretariat would look at, you know, funding at the academic level would be needs-based anyway. So it would be able to make arrangements for family relocation and access needs and so on. But in particular, it would be able to backfill the national systems where that was acutely needed.
So if I'm selected, fortunate enough to be selected to be the head of a, you know, or to establish a new discipline area for a few years hence, right? I've got to identify where that's going to be based.
Yeah, you would look at where are the key locations where that research will be best pursued.
Yeah, and assuming that most of those are in the Maldives or, you know, somewhere else really nice.
Yes.
Isn't it a bit off to have me being paid and indeed, you know, taking all my family there for 4 years on a bit of a jolly, or is there some element of rigor about this?
Yeah, well, when the initial applicants make a submission, which is going to need to be a rigorous research proposal, you don't get a research grant of any kind without real rigor, as we know, and this would require kind of the ultimate rigor. And there, it's a competition. So if people are, you know, chancing it in the Maldives, they might not get selected.
And so how big? Let's leave aside then, you know, the luxury locations. But in terms of if you have a, you know, the grouping of all the, you know, psychologists looking at a particular aspect of, you know, brain stuff, and there are, I mean, are there going to be 200 of them? Are there going to be 5,000 of them? I mean, how big are these activities going to be? And aren't they going to swamp a place if they suddenly all turn up with them, their families, their entourage, and all their books?
So there's an important distinction to be drawn between, if you like, the work happening during the four-year term, which is distributed across many locations.
Oh, right. Okay.
So it's not that they have to get together. I should clarify this. It's not that they have to get together and agree a location in which to operate for 4 years. It's that they're able to go wherever their research drives them in the world. Could be one site, could be multiple sites.
Right.
And to your question about scale, it's more towards the second end of what you described. So yes, several thousand staff.
Okay. How many administrators? This is a question,
Plenty, Paul. I can assure you. You know, the secretariat would be a significant organization and would have a 1,000 to 2,000 staff just on its own. I mean, it would be charged with the responsibility to not just administer, but also to support all these people in country doing complicated things. Many countries would be complicated local circumstances. So it requires this. And I'd have said, it would have a budget like the budget of Harvard, that we're talking about that scale, and it requires that significant support service. And I think there are a couple of pieces of central infrastructure that it would also kind of have. So in general, it doesn't have, major laboratories and that sort of stuff. It's not that kind of subject mix, I think, for obvious reasons. Yeah. But it would have a central, as part of the secretariat, a central knowledge sharing and engagement service. So that would incorporate its university press, which would be a global press, but would go way beyond that, supporting dissemination and knowledge exchange and public engagement in a wide variety of ways working across the world. And the other piece of infrastructure that it will have, which is much kind of harder edged, is it would have a world leading supercomputer that would be able to be flexibly deployed to support the research endeavors of the many different groups and clusters.
Okay, no, that's good. That's good. I like all that. Going back to the governance question then.
Yeah.
So I get that in terms of the kind of global setup, right? But where you can potentially run into challenges, I'm imagining, is when you're in the academic governance domain, right? Mm. Put simply, if you've stuck 3,000 academics in a grouping, right, and they're all arguing about something, right, they're not going to reach a conclusion, right? So how do you kind of prevent them just spending all their time in meetings talking about things that aren't the research?
I think really at the level of the research cluster, the only conversation is about the research. Now, the leading academics, the people leading the clusters would be engaged in some wider strategic discussions. Okay, but the whole point of it is to form dedicated research focused clusters that would operate like a very big research grant.
Okay, so that should actually be really attractive to people being involved in it, because what it means is that they don't have to worry about all the mundane stuff that you normally have to worry about a new university environment, and they have very few committees that they have to sit on.
Indeed.
So it's got to be a big draw for leading academics across the world.
I would have thought.
And those are a bit odd.
I think there are some other draws too, which would be draws for them, but also very important to the way this thing works. So because it is an international treaty organization, like an agency of the UN, the staff involved enjoy a range of privileges and immunities. So they would have, for instance, don't know, people may or may not know this, but UN officials and people like Interpol officers, they have passports issued by that agency. They're not quite passports, but they have laissez-passer travel documents that give them visa-free travel around the world.
So they don't have to wait in the queue.
So they don't wait in any queues. They're waved through immigration in most countries in the world, especially the Interpol ones, I guess. But the idea is that you can lever the international treaty organization status you've got to imagine it as a kind of global cadre of knowledge leaders roving around the world, engaging with each other and with national governments in the pursuit of multilateralism.
I mean, I like that as a did you say are there other privileges associated with it?
I mean, those are the main ones. You don't get you don't get off scot-free from just anything, but you don't under diplomatic immunity anyway.
That's really interesting. The other aspect of governance that you mentioned was the kind of assembly, I can't remember what you called it, the assembly every 4 years,
the plenary,
the Olympiad, which was,
indeed. I mean,
you referred to, its kind of subtitle is the Olympic University earlier on.
Yeah.
So does that involve sporting activity too then?
People are welcome to carry out sporting activity during
the pandemic. But it's not a structured part of the activity.
I mean, I just want to talk a little bit about what this plenary is, because you balked slightly at the idea that it might be 2 months long.
But, yes, I think everyone did, because that sounds like a real jolly moment.
Obviously. So the idea with the plenary is, think about a couple of thousand scholars. It wouldn't necessarily be everyone in every research cluster coming together in one location for an extended period of time in a major global city, Nottingham, for example, and which has the capacity to do that and to engage in interdisciplinary discussion, research presentation. And also this is where you would involve policy leaders who would come from around the world, coming from their governments with businesses and NGOs who would all visit the plenary to get involved. So it's quite a free roaming thing. And students would be able to get scholarships to attend the plenary and participate. And there could be a credit-bearing element, as I said.
Mm.
And so what you have to imagine this thing being, if I can put it like this, is a kind of anti-Davos. So it's that, but it is open, accessible, transparent, and with much, much more interesting people. And arriving by public transport, not by private jet or what have you. And that would be the kind of the thrust of it. And the reason why I really want it to be an extended period of coming together as a plenary is because it's something to do with the challenge of multilateralism in the 21st century. So I've really been thinking about, well, how do you address the challenge to multilateralism generated by just sheer time limitations and the amount of time that we, the international community, give each other, give ourselves to try to figure out these gigantic global problems. So to give you a few examples of what I mean by this, a century ago, the Paris Peace Conference met for 6 months after the First World War. Bretton Woods after the Second World War met for 3 weeks formally, but there was a lot of preparatory conferencing that went on. And we could debate the kind of merits and outcomes and legacies of those particular things. But the point is that the world invested the time, and the expertise in doing it. And we've got COP30 going on right now. It's 11 days. Now, how do you address the subject matter of that event in 11 days? The field of the cloth of gold was longer than COP30. And so my university is a way for the world to get serious about investing funding and time in multilateralism.
I mean, I think it would be a great event to be at. I'm not certain that Nottingham has the infrastructure really to cope with it, but it might be a few years off. So there is time.
Sure.
But for those who are there for the whole 2 months, it might be quite draining because I'm imagining there's a lot of fringe activity as well, not to mention all the sport we're talking
about. That's right.
Physicists against social scientists is going to be bloody, isn't it?
It is.
But I mean, it does sound like a worthwhile endeavor. And I think you're right about the investment of time, because time is actually just about the most precious commodity for researchers in many ways. And you're giving them time to undertake their research, but also you're giving them time to come together to solve the, if you like, the bigger, broader problems other than just their particular disciplines. And presumably the kind of interdisciplinary activity that emerges from that kind of 2 month long, cross-fertilization immersion must be really positive as well, because everyone's got time to mix with everyone, haven't they?
That would be the vision. And, for as it does, as with the Olympics itself, 4 years kind of goes in a flash. And before you know where you are, you're back again with your research group, engaging with them and with other new groups that have formed in the meantime, as well as with all these other participants.
Going back to the presidency, Graham, are you a candidate for the job? have you already assumed the presidency, or will it be more of a kind of global competition? How is the president appointed?
So appointment of the president would be on merit, and there'd be a governance, there'd be a global council which would, when there's a vacancy in the presidency, they would go for global search and find the new leader. I'd like to think that I have the vision to be an appropriate candidate.
Well, you'd be able to say my idea, guys.
Right, exactly. And I obviously I quite fancy an 8-year term in Vienna with a magic passport that gets me visa-free travel around the world. So why not?
But, why not? Okay.
Fundamentally, a merit-based and open process.
Which you would win.
Yes.
So are there other features of the university that we've not covered as much as we should? Because we focus very much on the research dimensions and the governance structures and issues around location and funding and so forth. Are there other things that we should have teased out, Graham?
We haven't talked about students much.
Yeah, mention a bit more about students.
I'll just say a little bit about that. I mean, the vast majority of the students, well, the only students actually enrolled would be research students.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're part of the research clusters, they're full members, they haven't yet gained their doctorate, and they gain their doctorate through that four-year term. So they're fully engaged in that four-year period and they're working on a doctoral project and doctoral thesis attached to their research cluster. And then the idea would be not everyone finishes a doctorate in 4 years, so it's renewable to take you on if necessary. But the idea would be that you'd try to synchronize it with the terms, and you'd have graduation ceremonies in the plenary. That would be rather nice. And the research students are getting these, you know, special travel privileges as well, and it would be a fantastic thing for any of them to have. And then the other kind of category of student who are involved, as I said, would be people only coming to the plenary, so undergraduates and postgraduates, and taking a credit-bearing course that's kind of associated with that. So that's sort of how the approach to students, mostly a research-intensive institution.
Okay. But that's really interesting. A couple of other really important questions. Yeah. Have you got a mascot?
Is there a mascot? Oh, I don't think there's a mascot. I don't think so.
All right, fair enough. Okay, so, you know, this is the era of culture wars and people, no platforming each other and claiming that their free speech has been stifled. But bearing in mind that you're trying to operate on a global scale, are you, and reflecting, you know, that laws and rules are different around the world, I mean, are you banning anything?
Generally, no. I mean, no. Yeah. Basically, no. There would be academic. I recognize this is a very complicated area doing something like this. So there would be academic freedom enshrined in the founding convention. Yeah. All the signatory nations would be making an agreement to protect that, and there would be a code of conduct for staff and students and people otherwise associated with it, grounded in research integrity and research ethics. And all the participating nations are making a commitment to protect that. Now, I would acknowledge that there are certainly nations in the world that wouldn't be up for signing up for that approach, and that's up to them. But, you know, we're aiming for as widespread participation as possible.
Okay, excellent. And then my final critical question, before I throw it open to the floor for any other questions, is, you know, every university has to have a song, an anthem. So what is your international multilateral Olympic anthem for this institution?
So I'd like something rousing that symbolizes the Olympic kind of theme and touches on university themes as well. So I'm going to go for the main theme from Chariots of Fire by Vangelis.
Oh, I like it. I think that works for me. That's a very, very good choice, Graham. Right, well, we've got a few minutes left. So let me see if anyone in our audience has got any questions. Now, Jim is poised with his roving microphone. I know it doesn't look like a roving microphone, but, you know, he knows what he's talking about. So has anyone got a question? Here we go. Over here, Jim.
Thank you, Graham. And thank you. That was a very imaginative idea. And if you don't get the presidency, maybe you could be the mascot and I could solve that problem. So just two things I'd be interested in hearing a bit more about. So firstly, around strategic decision making in terms of what research outcomes university would focus on. I was assuming that'd be driven by something like development goals or things like that. And if that is the case, what's the implication in terms of the representation of arts and humanities in the university? And the second thing I wanted to hear a bit more about was I can get the incentives for the participating countries and the academics, but what would be the incentives or the motivations for the universities who kind of currently host the academics to relinquish the potential IP, the time from those academics, potential reputation from the research that those academics would be undertaking in their institutions otherwise?
Mm. Ooh, some crunchy stuff there.
There is some crunchy stuff. Very helpful questions as well. So let me talk first about kind of collective decision-making and strategy. So I said the governance structures would be in the convention, but we slightly glossed over exactly kind of how that looks. So let's talk about that a little bit. The convention would set up the structures where that strategic discussion would happen. So it's not just a case of there's one president and then there's research cluster leaders. There's an intermediary. There are some intermediary institutions or bodies, and the leaders are participating in them. And something else I didn't say, which this gives me an opportunity just to drop in, is that all of this sounds incredibly radical, I'm aware, but there are some precedents for this kind of thing. There is the European University Institute in Florence, which is a university founded by an international treaty, and it has degree awarding powers, and it has the sorts of bodies that we're just talking about there for collective decision making about the research direction of the university. Or you could think about the OECD, which is not a university, but it is founded by, it is a major knowledge organization, yeah, and it is founded by international treaty. So we have visited as an international community these concepts before and figured out structures by which they are trusted to go through the process of working out what they ought to do, and are generally, I think, regarded as valuable. Although, of course, the UK withdrew from the European University Institute after Brexit, which we didn't need to do, and that's a rather sad thing to have happened, I think. You also asked me, Joe, about incentives. I think the terms are sufficiently long that actually these would be the substantive appointments for a lot of the people involved. So they would be getting another job. There's no, in that sense, no need for an incentive for their donor institution. But if donor institutions saw the great merit in having one of their staff participate in this highly well-resourced and prestigious research exercise, then they could be also secondments. So I wouldn't want to prescribe, you know, how that should be dealt with, not least because it might need to be dealt with quite differently in different countries, but there would be different options available.
Thank you.
Oh, you asked me about arts and humanities as well. I think with arts and humanities research would be within the remit of the institution, and the research clusters would be formed on arts and humanities-based research questions and topics. So it would be a fully integrated part of the institution.
And it's great. Thank you. Another question there.
Kind of a two-part question. Following on from the last question, would the rights for the exploitation of the IP be limited to the signatory countries, or would it be for generally the global good? And secondly, once you have the presidency, what would be your first project that you'd push for?
What a fantastic question. So to the IP question, I hadn't thought about that, but off the top of my head, I would probably say that, well, firstly, the question of how the intellectual property is handled would be a matter dealt within the convention, so in the treaty. I would think that the default position would be that the IP belongs collectively to the signatory nations. I would hope that most nations of the world would subscribe, and in general, the research outputs and knowledge generated would have a wider common value. As to the kind of what would kind of go in the first call, I mean, this might be a little bit circular and recursive, but I think it ought to have, as a kind of at the outset, at least one research cluster examining the question of multilateralism as its kind of founding mission, and the history, kind of the past, present, and future of that way of approaching international relations, which, as Paul hinted in a question, is, you know, we were very strong at that once in the world, and we perhaps regressed a little, perhaps regressed quite a lot, actually, in how well the world does that. And so I think that would be a worthwhile research program for someone.
Completely agree. Any other questions? One behind you, Jim. The joys of fixed seating in Senate House make this an entertaining prospect.
I want you to explain what the representation sequence like at the university.
Yeah. So as we've said, the only enrolled students are research students, but they would have rights and responsibilities detailed in the convention of the institution, and that would be the kind of starting point for how their voice should be expressed both within their research cluster, and then there will be multiple research students in a research cluster, so you kind of get a meaningful collective, and they would have rights to represent their views to the leader of the research cluster, and that would be structured in a range of ways. And then also there would be an organization within the secretariat that supports the wider organization of student voice across the whole institution, and also facilitates that that to happen because these students are working across the world. So you need, a very different kind of student body, student union.
We could have another research cluster dedicated to looking at student union.
You could.
Yeah.
I would support that.
Yes, good. I thought you would. Jim, over here, I'll come to you next. Sorry.
Thanks, Graham. And I'd like to just pick at the sort of quality assurance arrangements around this credit bearing module a little bit. Could you sort of, give us some guarantees around the quality? And are you using external examiners, for example? And also, this sounds like quite an interesting community to be a part of with the whole secret passports and everything. Is there a secret handshake?
I'll be honest, I haven't thought about the quality assurance of the credit bearing offer. For the research degrees, clearly there would be a whole machinery of quality assurance. But the credit-based kind of short courses with credit, I think that the issue there is that the value of that credit ultimately depends on its recognition by the institutions and countries where those students have come from. So the credit can be awarded by the university, and that would sit under its charter, under its convention. But how that's handled isn't something we can kind of legislate for. Is there a secret handshake? Well, if I told you, it wouldn't be a secret.
My question is around, I suppose, equality and diversity of research nations and research leads, in knowing that a lot of resource and excellence and finances very much in the global north, in the US and the UK. How might that disadvantage applicants from all countries or institutions where there isn't so much resource or funding invested in research who do want to participate but might not have the same opportunity or access or savvy or know-how?
Yes, absolutely. I see something fundamentally redistributive in the heart of the financial model of this institution. As I said when I answered Paul's question about funding arrangements, I would like to start from a place where the kind of anchor funders, the core funders of the G20 nations, and that would, they would be funding it to a significant extent that would allow for other nations, developing countries and other countries that don't have a major research capacity to participate for free or for a much more nominal cost in the institution as a signatory. And then at the staff and student level, I want to see a very large portion of the $7 billion being used to make sure that the participatory needs of those scholars, wherever they come from, can be met, and that they can be supported to the extent needed to make sure that they can participate as a full member of the academic community of this institution. And so for many people, that will involve supporting all sorts of things that a university or a national student funding system would not support. But the secretariat would have the authority and the power to identify what those needs are and then to make the grants necessary to meet them.
Folks, we're going to have to draw it to a close there, but it's been a really terrific exposition of a very novel and indeed far-reaching university which Graham has created, which I'm sure will have a long-lasting global impact when he becomes its first president and secures funding from all of those areas he suggested. And, who knows, may present a really refreshing antidote to the activities of, crazed egotistical trillionaires who want to go to Mars.
So
I think it will be a very different kind of offer. So Graham, let me say thank you. And it's great having you on the podcast. Thank you very much, everyone.
I do hope you enjoyed that episode of My Imaginary University. There'll be more along before you know it. In the meantime, you might want to listen to the sister podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I chat to university leaders and registrars and others like that, all about their experiences of higher education. Just Google it. Also, you may want to visit my website, wonderfulhighered.com, where you can find lots of entertaining stuff all about the strange, wonderful and frightening world of higher education. Anyway, until the next time, thank you for listening.